This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Hello, and welcome again to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our 23rd episode. Today, we look at a recent study published in the JCENM that attempts to understand the connection between metrics from continuous glucose monitoring and complications in type 1 diabetes, as well as how those metrics evolve over time. As is frequently the case for the studies we review, these investigators use an observational design, so we will think about the limitations that go along with these studies and whether we think the data supports the conclusions that the authors draw. I host the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast, working as a general endocrinologist at Vanderbilt University, where I direct our outpatient clinics and am an associate director for our fellowship program. Joining me today for the first time as our regular contributor is Allison Myers from the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. She works at the Montefiore Medical Center as an endocrinologist and is the associate chair for diversity, equity, and inclusion in their Department of Medicine. Importantly for our discussion today, one of her clinical and research areas of expertise is diabetes technology. Our guest expert today comes to us from Northwestern University. Grazia Aleppo is well known to you as our listeners as an expert in type 1 and type 2 diabetes, particularly around pump and sensor technology. She has numerous publications in this area and is an in-demand speaker and educator on these topics. So, as you can tell, I have the perfect pair of endocrinologists joining me today for this discussion, and welcome them both. As usual, everything we discuss will be our opinions only and not necessarily those of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. For this episode of the podcast, we review relationship between time and range, glycemic variability, hemoglobin A1C, and complications in adults with type 1 diabetes mellitus, which was published in the February 2022 edition of the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Anas El Malahi and Michelle Van Ilsen from the University Hospital Antwerp and Sarah Charlier from the University Hospitals Leuven shared the first author role for this paper, with the other authors coming from a variety of institutions throughout Belgium. Now I will turn things over to Allison. She will walk us through the author's introduction and hit the highlights there, with her and Grazia periodically stopping to give us an overview of several key concepts around diabetes technology. Allison?
Thank you so much, Chase. It's great to be here today. So we know that traditionally the goal for most people with type 1 diabetes has been a hemoglobin of less than 7%. But sometimes and in certain cases that can change. So Dr. Aleppo, can you comment on how goal setting has changed over the years in our patients with type 1 diabetes?
First of all, hello, Chase. Hello, Allison. It's good to be with you guys. I know you for a while, so please call me Grazia. So yes, the A1C targets have changed in the sense that now we pay attention so much more to comorbidities, we pay attention to the age and the frailty of the patient. If the patient is frail with a short lifespan, we don't want to be at 7%. We want to be much more lean. In fact, the ADA standards of care do have some recommendation for older adults with diabetes, whether type 1 or type 2, to really try to have a more gentle approach. But most importantly, whether the A1C is going to be 7 or 8 or another value, we need to pay attention to avoid hypoglycemia at all costs, especially in the more vulnerable population.
Patients with type 1 diabetes also used to have to do capillary blood glucose testing 4 to 7 times a day. But now with continuous glucose monitors or CGMs, this is no longer needed. There are several CGMs that are currently on the market. Grazia, can you comment on the different types of CGMs and the difference between flash versus non-flash CGM?
Yes, this is the time for CGM. I tell you, there is so much happening in the CGM market right now. And so there are two main types of CGM, real-time and intermittent scanning. The differences between the two is that the real-time brings the data to the patient passively on either reader or a phone, a smart app on the phone, whereas the intermittent scanning gets the information transferred from the sensor transmitter unit to a reader to a smartphone app when the patient flashes or scans these readers to the disk. And it's important to remember that this disk, the sensor and transmitter unit of the flash in this case, doesn't have much of a memory. So that's why the user needs to scan at least every 6 to 8 hours so that the memory doesn't get lost and the data is not interrupted with a lot of gaps. So that's important. The other thing that the difference between these two also is that there are, again, passive and predictive alerts in the real-time CGM, while at this time the flash CGM has optional alarms, but they're not predictive. So they give you a beep when you are low, but you don't know if you're high or low, and you need to just take a look. You can also turn them off. By default, they're turned on. You also have a wide variety of duration of sensors right now. You have 7 days, 10 days, 14 days, 90 days, and not even 180 days. But also remember, the sensor don't work all the same these days. In the past, it was just one method, and it was the glucose oxidase method. But now the sensor also works, especially the Eversense from Senseonics work with the fluorescent system. So again, these are changing with time. And of course, the most appealing thing is that they are not only used for dosing insulin without the need for confirmatory blood glucose finger stick, but also that they can be integrated in automated insulin delivery system, which is the best part of this whole thing.
Yes, and this is so great, especially for people with neuropathy, where they say it's very painful to use finger stick testing. So in this paper, one of the other things that they highlight is the fact that we can use the hemoglobin A1C to predict complications, because it's unfortunately one of the only metrics we have that's strongly correlated with chronic complications. But as we all know, it has limitations in its use. So for people who have hemoglobinopathies, such as sickle cell disease, or even just sickle cell trait, we know that the hemoglobin A1C might actually be a little bit lower compared to what the fasting glucose is. We've seen that in some studies. Also, we know that people with end-stage renal disease or other forms of anemia, such as iron deficiency anemia, can also have false elevations or lowering of their hemoglobin A1C. And even we've seen in rate, there are racial differences. There have been studies that show, there was actually a study with the CGM, which showed that when you correlate the A1C with the actual fasting glucose, there was a slight, it was like 0.3 to 0.4% difference amongst Black patients compared to whites. So we do know that even though that A1C is a great 3-month average measure for diabetes and it correlates well with the rate of complications, there are some variations that can occur with it. In this study, they were seeking to find the association between baseline hemoglobin A1C and the CGM-derived glucometrics, which included time in range, also known as TIR, coefficient of variation, also known as CV, as well as SD or standard deviation. And the presence of chronic and acute complications was investigated in a large group of adults with type 1 diabetes using sensor augmented pump therapy. So these are people that are on have CGMs, but they're also integrated with insulin pump therapy. So now we will focus on the methods and I will turn it back to you, Chase.
Great. Thanks, Allison, and grazie as well. So I think that really nicely sets up the great opportunity that we have here with continuous glucose monitoring and what we know from that, the benefits that we're aware of, but then also a lot of the unknowns that are out there and how well that correlates with more of the long-term complications that we're hoping to prevent in the first place. So now, as usual, we're going to take a close look at the methodology that's used here. And what we're going to start with is thinking about a couple of different study designs, including cross-sectional design and prospective cohort studies. We will look at how the author describe their work here shortly. But first of all, I just want to describe these two things in general, and then we can think about which of these might apply to different parts of the study. So first of all, cross-sectional studies, those come from, as the terminology uses, a cross-section of a population. So it takes a group of individuals, a group of subjects, and collects data all at a single point in time, or at least at a relatively limited point in time, and compares the relationship between the different factors that are measured here. And when they look at them, they will describe different factors as either an exposure or an outcome. But an intrinsic limitation to cross-sectional studies is that you often don't clearly know which predated another. And so as you set up a relationship, you'll describe it as, well, this is likely to be the driver of something else. But when the data is all collected at a single point in time, that you don't necessarily know that that's true. So you always have to think about the possibility of if there is a relationship between those, is it possible that actually what you have labeled as the outcome is the cause of what you have labeled as the exposure. So we're going to come back and think more about that. So that those are cross-sectional studies. And then the other study that we want to think about is a prospective cohort study. So a cohort study is when you have a group of individuals, that's your cohort, and then typically you will split them into one or sometimes multiple different groups, and then you follow them over time. So the big thing that makes a cohort study different from a cross-sectional is this time component. is that you're starting a study and then you're able to put people into different groups based on an exposure. And then you follow them over time to look to see who develops an outcome and who doesn't. So that is much stronger as a study design because you're able to clearly establish this link here between an outcome developing over time, because you can exclude anybody that had that outcome at the very beginning. So we're going to think about that a little bit more. Okay, so now back to this study. So the authors describe their study in the methods as a prospective multi-center observational cohort study. So they use that terminology of a prospective cohort study. So we're going to come back and think about that here in a second. As far as the details of who is in this study, so they had 515 Belgian adults with type 1 diabetes on insulin pump therapy. Allison mentioned that already. And all subjects who entered into this program that we'll describe shortly were included. So they didn't make any exceptions. If you were in this program, your data was included in this investigation. These individuals were recruited between September 2014 and January 2017, and then data collection continued all the way up through March of 2019. A few requirements that were here, the biggest one is that they had to wear their continuous glucose monitor for at least 70% of the time, and they also had to upload their data monthly. Now, the authors make a note here in the methods about how healthcare, in particular around type 1 diabetes, works in Belgium, and they note that in Belgium, type 1 diabetes care is delivered in specialist centers. As we were thinking about that and wrestling with that, Allison had raised some questions related to that in particular, well, about the population at all. So we're thinking about these are all from a single country. And so thinking about how a homogenous population there, and we'll actually look at the data around the population when we get to the results, but how that might have an effect. And then also thinking about how individuals get into these studies. So we'll stop and get any thoughts on Allison, since you had raised that concern about how applicable this population might be to other populations. We'll start with you, and then after that, we'll get Grazia's thoughts on the impact that this might have.
Absolutely. As a provider in the Bronx, a large number of our patients are not just going to be Caucasian, as was in the study. We have a large number of patients who are Black, Latino, as well as Asian. So for me, I'm not sure if this is something I can extrapolate for my patient population, which is so diverse. The other thing, this was a majority all-female population. So that was another issue. Does that also mean that we can extrapolate this for our male patients? The other interesting thing of note is that their patients all go to a diabetes specialist center. I'm an endocrinologist. You both are endocrinologists. So when we see our patients, yes. But you know that we also have patients here in the U.S. that PCPs or a nurse practitioner in medicine is writing them for their CGM and or their pump. So, you know, I think that some of these differences that we see here in the United States make it a little difficult at times to say, okay, yes, we can definitely take this data and use it for our patient populations.
The other thing is also that remember that in Europe, in many countries in Europe, actually, things are covered by the national health system. So a few things that are very important in the States, such as access and cost, are not really an issue in those countries. At the same time, though, we need to remember that many patients in those countries don't have access to pump. They got to go to a hospital to get a pump, like in the UK. So there are so many nuances that make the study perhaps a bit less applicable to the States, but the information that is gathered from it makes us think for sure.
And the other thing that I would add, and this is true for any of these type of studies that we have to think about, is the possibility of a volunteer bias. And generally speaking with that is that the individuals who tend to be involved in these sort of studies are usually not representative of the population at large. And so yet another thing, we don't throw out the results of that. We just have to understand that with the individuals who are involved in this study, how this looks at a population that's different than the populations that we care for, that functions in a healthcare system that's different than ours, is that there may be some limitations in how we apply that. So something we'll have to think about later. So back to this study again, the outcomes, there are several different outcomes that the authors describe. So first of all, what they list as their primary outcome is they are interested in looking at the association between the time and range from the first 2 weeks of CGM use and then composite microvascular complications at that time, at study initiation. So the first thing is that I would suggest here is when you look at this, and there are several other outcomes that we'll come to here in a second, but the primary outcome, the way the authors describe this, is I would say that there isn't really a time component here. So even though they describe their study as a prospective cohort study, this, their primary outcome, best functions as a cross-sectional study. Yeah, there's a couple of weeks of data, so it's not just at a single point in time, but that's how they're looking at it. They're looking at all this data at a relatively close point in time. They're not following people over time to see if outcomes develop. They're saying at this single point in time, What's the time and range? How does that compare then to the outcome of microvascular complications that already exist? So I thought that would be another thing that would be helpful to discuss. And in particular, as I mentioned before, with cross-sectional studies, you always have to think about the possibility that what you've labeled as your outcome is actually the cause. So Grazia alluded to this earlier when she said that, well, we've really started to think differently about how we set goals for diabetes control, and that if somebody is young and doesn't have any complications, then we tend to be fairly aggressive. But the older that they get and the more complications that they get, we loosen that control. So I wanted to raise at least the possibility of, could this actually be the opposite? Is that these individuals started to develop complications, and so their providers intentionally decided to be less aggressive with their care. And so that's why we're seeing less time in range. It's because of the complications, not the opposite. And I don't know that we're going to really get to an answer here, but at least wanted to raise that. So Grazia, since you had talked about goal setting before, does that seem feasible to you, or not very likely to be the case as far as what we know about these group of individuals?
Thank you, Trace. It's a very good point, because when I was looking at the paper, I was a little bit surprised that over time, maybe it's premature to just show the results, but the time and range did not improve. In fact, went down. And so that was a bit concerning to me, because if anything, it should be better, because if you follow these patients regularly and you do actually use the SAP, the AID, all this, you know, enhanced pump therapy, patients usually tend to do better. So it's a question whether the presence of the concern for this potential microvascular presence of some beginning of complication would have made the providers perhaps be less aggressive. But we also don't know how diabetes is following those countries. So we don't know the frequency of the appointment, what kind of interventions the patients do. We just don't have that information. But that is, of course, something we could consider to be the reason why the many things did not change over the 24 months following the initial 2 weeks.
And Chase, I would just also like to add the point that one of the things that is really important in this population is FOH, also known as fear of hypoglycemia. So, you know, for a lot of patients, when they see that their sugar is trending, that arrow is going down, they may be hesitant to deliver that bolus that the bolus wizard is recommending. So, you know, that could also be that people are now actually more conscientious, paying attention to these arrows more. So you actually had a bias going the other way, and they might be less inclined to follow what the pump is suggesting.
What I've also noted is that in patients, especially in other countries, they get to the pump when the A1C is higher. And so they could also be another concern. The patient was put on a pump because they were having more challenges. And just something we need to think about the way this is done in other countries.
So to clarify one terminology, so the authors are looking at composite microvascular complications, and what they mean by that is a combination of neuropathy, retinopathy, and nephropathy. They also looked at several secondary outcomes. So again, they're looking at that association between that glucometric data, but when the secondary outcomes, they're looking at individual microvascular complications, also looking at macrovascular complications and hospitalizations as well. And then finally, with outcomes, how the authors describe it as additional outcomes is they are interested in seeing the evolution of the glucometrics over those 2 years. Grazia mentioned that already, and Allison's going to walk us through that in the results. But this, I would say, is really the only part of this study that truly functions as a prospective cohort study, because it has that time component. So you're starting with people, you're roughly putting them into groups based on the time and range, and then you're looking to see how that develops over time. So that functions as a cohort study, but as the authors describe it, as a relatively minor part, not either a primary outcome or one of the secondary outcomes as they describe it. So a few words on the data collection. So the authors do a great job of describing how they define the microvascular and macrovascular complications. With hospitalizations, because they're interested in looking at those, they are patient reported, but then they validate those with hospital records to confirm the accuracy there. And one final comment that I would make in the methods is that with these investigations, particularly around the microvascular and macrovascular complications, they do define them very well as to what they mean by someone having a complication. I found it a little unclear, though, as how consistently those were investigated. And I raise that because it's possible that they are being looked for differently in different individuals. Now, we think of microvascular complication that's supposed to happen on an annual basis. And so potentially everybody got the exact same investigation there, but it's a lot less defined, particularly in the United States, as far as macrovascular complications, who's supposed to be investigated for those, how you're supposed to look for them. And so it's unclear if everybody got investigated for that or if only people who had concerning signs or symptoms. I would raise that because it introduces the possibility of an ascertainment bias, that if you had an individual and their diabetes control was worse, and because their control is worse, you're more worried about, say, a peripheral arterial disease, and so you go looking for PAD a little bit more because of that, that would be an ascertainment bias if you're not investigating all individuals the same. So it was a little bit unclear to me exactly how that was done. So I think another thing that we would need to be thinking about as far as a possible limitation. And at this point, we'll turn things back over to Allison. So now that we understand the methodology here, we're going to look at the results, and it's a lot of data that she's going to walk us through, but we'll turn it over to her now to do that.
Thank you, Chase. So as mentioned earlier before, this was a relatively homogeneous population of 515 patients in Belgium, most of whom were female, 59%, 64% were highly educated, 97% were Caucasian. The average age was 42.2 plus or minus 12.3 years. So this was a relatively middle-aged population. So you probably had less of the pressures of trying to get tight glycemic control for pregnancy at this point, which, you know, also would change things if we had a much more average age in the 20s or 30s, probably in terms of where our glycemic control is. So that's also something else that causes a slight bias here. The average duration of diabetes is actually quite long. Most of these patients had diabetes at least 22 years, plus or minus 11.6. So that in itself also kind of gives you a bias because of the fact that if you had diabetes that many years, there's a good chance that you should have had developed complications as opposed to if you had a population who had 5 years or less. Average pump year usage, believe it or not, was 5.7 years. And the reason why I say believe it or not is you would think, to Grazia's point earlier, that because most of these people have been on a pump for almost 6 years, they would have better glycemic control. But just because someone's on a pump, that doesn't always mean that. And then a large percent, to my point about fear of hypoglycemia, 47%, nearly half, have self-reported hypoglycemia unawareness. So that is concerning, and that probably is part of the driving force as to why their A1Cs are hovering almost around 8. I find that most people who have fear of hypoglycemia tend to run their A1C high 7, 8, sometimes even low 9 because of this up and down dance of my sugar's dropping, I'm going to overcorrect, and then my sugar's going to go up. And then I'm going to bolus to bring it down, but I might bring it down too much, and there's this constant up and down, which is going to lead to increased variability, which is one of the metrics that they checked and we will talk about in a little bit. So I posed to the group, based on what I just mentioned in terms of who was in this study, what are some of the things that we can say about the participants and how it lent itself to generalizability of the results? So I'll start with Grazia and then Chase, if you have something to add.
So again, think about these patients with 20 to 30 years of diabetes who might have been on a regular pump and then maybe placed on a sensor augmented pump because of concerns for hypoglycemia. When you have half of the group, 250 some people having hypoglycemia awareness, it's a significant concern because you know exactly they might have more variability. Sometimes they might be more gentle. We have a population with a study in the past on hypoglycemia in older adults, and they sometimes when were running high, the ones who had hypoglycemia awareness at night did not take much insulin because they were concerned. And we discovered that when we did a CGM on these patients. So it's a very good point. And as far as the A1C level, this could explain why the A1C is not lower. But then again, as you say, the pump is not the solution. The patient and the pump and the CGM together with the provider really make a difference. But it's better to be individualized. And so this patient might have been uneasy or uncomfortable doing, you know, aggressive stuff with their glucose level. That would explain the population of this. It actually really applies to our country as well. We have so many patients who are afraid of hypoglycemia. You're right about that.
And then I think the other thing that I was thinking about when I looked at this is wondering, because I think you're right, you could look at that nearly half of these folks with hypoglycemia unawareness, try to understand, well, what does that mean? Does that just mean that they're all over the place? I think another possibility that we don't know is that it's possible that there's quite a substantial number of these folks that are very tightly controlled to the point to where they're having hypoglycemia so frequently that they're unaware of it. And to some degree, that would fit with an A1C of 7.6, as I think along with that, with what Allison said, is so know that on average, they're not at goal. I think it's important to note, and the authors point this out later, which we'll look at, they're not poorly controlled. So these aren't, this is not an average A1C of 9 or 10. Grazia had mentioned this scenario. Sometimes we'll push people to sensors or pumps just in the hope that we can get their control better, because what we're doing right now is not working. But that by and large is not these individuals. So these are not folks who are very poorly controlled. And so I think that'll have an impact as we look at particularly how that data evolves over time.
Yeah. And roughly slightly over a third of these patients already had at least one microvascular complication, most of which was actually retinopathy. And, you know, we always learn that retinopathy and nephropathy are usually a package deal. And it was interesting that 29% of them had retinopathy, whereas only 10% of them had nephropathy. So I don't know if maybe the nephropathy was missed, but it was just a little odd. I thought there was the discordance there that, you know, you had probably three times as many people with positive retinopathy compared to nephropathy. And also only 13% of them had neuropathy. And that's usually something you see the most. So I was just a little surprised that there was actually more eye disease in this population than you saw of the other microvascular components. Some of the things they also looked at were the changes over time. So again, to what Tracy described earlier, looking over 24 months to see if there were changes in hemoglobin A1C, as well as these indices that they were looking at for the CGM. So the hemoglobin A1C did have some slight improvement. So even though the time in range didn't improve, the hemoglobin A1C improved, which also speaks to the fact that sometimes the time in range and A1C don't always necessarily correlate. After over 24 months, there was actually a decrease in the A1C from 7.6 to 7.3%. The time in range actually, you would have expected to go up, but it actually went down. Usually when the time in range is 70% or more, that's really good. I mean, that usually also denotes that the A1C is less than 7%. In this population, the time in range at baseline was 62.9%, but at 24 months, it actually declined slightly to 60.8%, which was an unexpected finding. Because again, you would expect if the A1C improved, the time in range should have gone up, not down. I mean, you could argue that going up by like 2% doesn't seem like a lot, but in A1C, it would be a lot, obviously. But you could argue that in time in range, that's not a lot. But you would think they would be getting closer to 70%, not further away. The variability actually decreased, which was a good thing. I mean, it went from 38.6 to 37, but the standard deviation did not change over time. So in summary, the A1C got better, but the time in range got worse. The standard deviation didn't change, and the variability actually also improved. And then they did a comparison of those who met the goal of time in range, which again is 70%. And they compared it to those who were not at goal, where their time in range was less than 70%. And they found that those that were not meeting their goal, surprisingly, they had been on the pump longer. This again speaks to our point that Grazia made earlier, is that it's not the pump, it's the patient. This was not a surprise. They actually also had a worse A1C at baseline, 7.9 versus 7.1%. They also had a higher standard deviation. They also had a higher amount of variability, and also more complications and more hospitalizations. So that made sense. So having a lower time in range went with more complications, more hospitalizations, more glucose variability, a higher hemoglobin A1C and standard deviation. The odd man out was the fact that those patients were on the pump longer. So again, big take home point is it's not the pump, it's the patient. In terms of variability, we know that having greater variability is associated with more complications. The study actually found that it was greater in those who were younger, had a lower time in range, higher hemoglobin A1C, and went on the pump longer. Standard deviation, they really couldn't assess it well because there's no across-the-board cutoff for standard deviation like there is for time in range or for variability. So they just arbitrarily picked greater than 61. And they found that those who had a standard deviation greater than 61 had a 2.8 increased risk of macrovascular disease. The other thing is they did a further logistic regression analysis, and they found that the diabetes duration, as well as time in range, were both independent risk factors for composite microvascular complications. So again, that's retinopathy, neuropathy, and nephropathy, but there was no association with macrovascular complications. So again, it was associated, diabetes duration and time in range were associated with composite microvascular complications, but there was no association with the macrovascular complications, which was MI, peripheral arterial disease, EKG changes suggestive of ischemia. Also, they found that retinopathy, not nephropathy or neuropathy, was also associated with having lower time in range. And again, we have to keep in mind that at baseline, there was a greater amount of neuropathy in this group compared to those other two microvascular indices. And time and range was the only variable which was independently associated with hospitalizations for DKA or hypoglycemia. Other indices such as hemoglobin A1C, standard deviation, variability were not. Pump duration, as well as diabetes duration, also were not. So time and range was shown to be associated with having increased complications and increased hospitalizations in patients. And so now we will dive further into the results by reviewing the discussion and conclusion. I will pass it over to you, Chase.
Great. Thanks, Allison. So yeah, we're going to think really carefully about the conclusions that the authors draw and if they're warranted based on the data that Allison just reviewed for us. First of all, what I'm going to give you is the way the authors describe their conclusions at a very high level. So they make a couple of big points. So first of all, they point out that individuals who have a time in range of greater than 70% had fewer microvascular complications and fewer hospitalizations. And then the second main point that they make is related to independent risk factors. And again, this is via the logistic regression. So the independent risk factors for microvascular complications are the A1C, the diabetes duration, the time in range, and the standard deviation. For macrovascular complications, the independent risk factors are age and the A1C. And then for hospitalization, the independent risk factor is time in range. And the authors also point out that there's a few unexpected findings. So as was mentioned before, they said, well, there's no link between either the standard deviation or the variability, the variation, and hypoglycemia risk. So they were expecting to see that, and they did not see that. And they also had an unexpected finding that high glucose variability did not put individuals at a higher risk for hospitalization. So another thing that we're not expecting to see. And then finally, as far as the points that the authors make here, is the results from the prospective component that following individuals over time, they point out that there's actually minimal change in control over time. Grazia mentioned that earlier as a bit of a surprising finding. Now, the authors point out that this may be because the patients had relatively good control, so there wasn't a huge area to improve in. As we talked about before, this was not a group that had an A1C of 9 or 10 that had a huge area for improvement, but with that, they didn't see much evolution over time in those glucometrics. Okay, so now we're going to think carefully here. And what we're going to start with is the way that the authors describe their limitations. So they point out a few, and we're going to think about those and see if there's any that we would add. So first of all, a limitation that the authors suggest is they say, well, we really did focus mostly on the cross-sectional analysis. So that really did limit the ability to assess a temporal or causal association. And we talked about that a little bit earlier. And the authors point out here that, well, one of the challenges is with doing something in real time is that a prospective study would need to be really long. You have to be looking at a study of at least 10 years to start getting this information, and that you couldn't really randomize people anymore. So you couldn't redo on studies from decades ago to where you're randomizing people to tight control or loose control and then following them over time. So I thought I'd get an input from Grazia and Allison. Grazia, we can start with you. Thoughts on that? So we don't, they have a little bit of time to follow people, but there's not a lot of information that we got from that. Do you see that this is something that's going to be feasible? Do you think that we're going to be able to have a study that follows people in time, looking particularly at how complications develop based on glucometric data?
So actually, I went back preparing for this presentation, this podcast, to the DCCT trial. Okay. To have 50 patients with infarct, microvascular complication, it took like 20 some years. So they had the first paper published 2015, 16, something like that. And they ended up in 1993. So you need to realize how it takes a long time to develop microvascular complications and how, in this case, what would be a wonderful idea would be to do registries like the one I have in Germany, in Scotland, I believe, or Wales. And even in the States, we used to have the T1D exchange. Following people longitudinally is like an edicts idea, you know, the outcome after the DCCT study. They can really say, okay, you fall over 20 years, what happened to you? One thing that I also wanted to mention was, yes, they say that they had the glycemic variability was not really a risk for hospitalization, but this was only for the first 2 weeks of use. So we don't know in the cross-sectional method whether they were the first 2 weeks, they were on sensor for more than 2 weeks. The temporal that you were mentioning before, Chase, how it's important to really make us understand where were these patients that experienced with CGM? We could have caught them at the first time they used a CGM, and we don't know they're getting used to seeing the data. the pump is getting used to them to adjust the insulin dose. So we don't know how the therapy, the person, the CGM impacted these 2 weeks data that they use for this cross section, right? But also think about it. You cannot make a patient, you cannot make another DCTT trial. It is unethical. But I tell you something, time and range and variability have a huge impact, at least in my experience, in retinopathy. So we work with a great group of retinologists here in our institution. And when patients have flatter blood sugar with less variability, they might even stop getting the injection of VEGF, anti-VEGF. When they get again up and down, they go back to get this monthly injection. So again, retinopathy has been notoriously been more weak in terms of more prone to this variability of glucose and cause more. It's a shift also, remember, fluid and VEGF activation. So that makes sense. Now, the other thing, we don't have data for that, right? There is no data right now, but it's something to think about as far as these complications. But for the macrovascular, we need to wait 20 years. So it's challenging to do these studies.
I kept wondering, could they have just formed a control group of people who were using just insulin pens or syringes, where they could have done like an age, sex matched registry comparing to the CGM users and just put CGMs on people that weren't using pumps to see if there was any real difference? Because obviously it's not the pump measures that they're looking for. They're just looking at CGM measures. So I was just kept wondering, well, why didn't they just do an age, sex match control with a control group of patients who just use injections? Any thoughts on that?
So the use of CGM in Europe is very wide with the Libre, which is pretty considered a substitution to glucose measurements, although it's a tool, it's a CGM for all practical purposes, but it scans, so you need to get the data in different fashion. But again, this was not an interventional study, it's an observational study. So they did not have two groups, although they could have and they should have perhaps do that. It should have done that, excuse me, because they would have given us an understanding how maybe there is a different role of CGM in MDI and the variability is more. So, but that would have shifted the concern to is pump versus MDI and the CGM on top. So again, these are difficult things to ascertain in a short period of time. But if you make some category of patients and say, if you still have 70%, then you say progress, is it getting better? So we don't have that information, but that would have been an interventional trial, not so much an observational trial. If how the study was published to be, if I'm correct.
So now let's keep going on with limitations that the authors identified. So that was the first one. The second one, as they point out, is always appropriate in observational studies, is the concern of residual confounding. And as a quick reminder, confounding is when you have a factor, a driver, an exposure that's related to what you have labeled as your exposure. So in this situation, we're talking about a variety of glucometric data. We'll take time and range as one example of that. So if there is something else that is very tightly associated with time and range, but then it is that other factor that's driving the outcome that you're looking at. So some of the ones that the authors point out as far as residual confounding that could have occurred is smoking, lipids, blood pressure, cardioprotective agents. And they point out that they didn't have a lot of that information, so it was difficult to factor that in. And so I would say anything else that we can think of here, and because I do think this would be important, particularly around macrovascular complications, because I do think that you would have to worry that some of these other things I might track along with what an individual's time and range is, and that it could be one of these other things that's really driving these outcomes, particularly the macrovascular complications. But anything else that we would have concern about as far as residual confounding that wasn't accounted for here?
Was there use off-label or not of other agents like GLP-1s, SGLT2 inhibitors? I don't know if maybe they were using those in some of these patients as well, which could have definitely been a confounder.
And also, SGLT2 are approved in Europe for use for type 1, so we don't know if they use those anyway. But also, we don't know what the percentage of people use lipid, lowering agents, statins, blood pressure. Maybe that's why the nephropathy was not so established compared to the retinopathy. There are so many things we don't know because there's these confounding factors, of course, and the author do mention that, obviously.
Finally, the authors point out that they used a time and range goal of 70% and that they didn't analyze their data using the 50% cutoff that's been proposed for high-risk patients, though they also point out that nobody in this group would really meet criteria for a frail person, as they described it, and so they didn't have a big concern. They didn't really have a reason to use 50% for any of these individuals, but a potential limitation in that we wouldn't be able to assess it based on that cutoff. Any other limitations, though, Grazia or Allison, that you would raise as concerns about this study and the way it was designed?
right now, the truth, the study really was, as you were mentioning, Chase, more a cross-section for the main component. And so I would like to see more of a long-term, like follow for 2 years. And in 2 years, you might see a worsening of microvascular complication. And whether that change in the time and range, whether going down or up, we don't know, of course, would have made a difference. I would love to see a study like that that will make a very good impact in a literature to really encourage us to do whatever the results would be, to just look at this in a different way.
Good. So let's come back to that in just a second. Let's sit tight there, because I think that'll be a great place for us to end at thinking about this study and then what else we might want if we need other information to change our practice moving forward. So we'll sit tight with that. And then what we'll wrap up with, though, is the strengths that the authors describe, a couple of them. So one of them is that they report a strength of their study is the size of the study and also the detailed characteristics that they provide. They point out a few that they didn't have, but they did have quite a bit of information. And so I would like to get our group's input if we agree with that, if we really think that the size is adequate here, and that if we truly know enough about these individuals, given the limitations around some of those confounders that we've already talked about.
So the study wasn't powered, but because, again, Mr. Grazia's point that it's an observational study, you technically don't have to. So it's a little hard to say, you know, if it was over underpowered because it wasn't set up in that type of way. But I think you can say that they did have a fairly good number of patients, but I think they would then have to go back and use their results to come up with a power calculation to really see how many patients they would need to really prove the point they're trying to make.
And then a final strength that the authors point out is that they have 2 years of data. And I think we won't belabor this point. We've hit it a few times, but it is very limited information that comes from that 2 years of data. The vast majority and all the main points that the authors make come from that initial 2 weeks. So I think it's a fairly limited strength of having that additional 2 years, because there's not very much that the authors are able to do with that data. So what I will end with here is the author's conclusion, and I'll quote it here. Time and range was independently associated with the presence of composite microvascular complications, retinopathy, and with hospitalizations resulting from hypoglycemia or ketoacidosis. So where I'd like us to start with a couple of items to close out, and Grazia, we'll start with you here. But as far as, give me a description, quality of this report overall, what are your thoughts on this study in and of itself?
So it gives good stuff to people. They follow for 2 years, all the data, the various glucometrics. The one thing that is a bit less strong is the fact that they look at only those 2 weeks. I would have hoped to see that for a long time. And why is that? Because we want to also know whether the time and range decrease with a cost of difference. That's very important, because we're trying to make an assumption that the better time in range makes a difference. Well, we don't know with this study if that really took place. So that was my concern about the study, although 2 years to see how the glucometrics move is a good description, but for the purpose of understanding the value of the increase in time in range over complication over time, that was not accomplished because the data was not provided.
Allison, your thoughts on the study overall?
I think that what they were trying to do was noble, but again, to Grazia's point, the a longitudinal study would have been much more helpful, especially when someone's had diabetes already for 20 something years to only focus on 2 weeks. It's a little bit hard to use such limited data for people who have been dealing with this disease for so long. One other thing I forgot to mention earlier is that only 5% of them actually had macrovascular disease, which I thought was a bit surprising. Maybe because in the United States, we have more obesity, we would see more, but I was a little surprised that there was such a low rate of macrovascular complications in this particular population. But I do think that there were definitely some strengths in terms of trying to see, are there other ways of trying to make associations beyond hemoglobin A1C in terms of what people developing complications. So I do give them credit for that, because I think we do sometimes forget that there's other things that we can measure besides A1C. And that, because as I mentioned earlier, there are things that make A1C not a perfect index of measurement, that it's good to start looking at some of these other possible coefficients in terms of correlation between the levels and possible complications.
Good. And Grazia, let's end with you here. So our final questions, we think about potentially changing our practice. And I think the alternatives are, we have all the information we need from this. I think we change our practice based on this, or this is more of a springboard and we maybe need a little bit more information to really understand if our practice can comfortably change. And if so, if it's that latter option, then what other information do we need? How else could a study be designed that would actually tell us what we really need to know to confidently change the care that we deliver for folks with type 1 diabetes?
Well, but this shows us that microvascular complications are present when there is less time in range. So we shouldn't forget that, even though it was only 2 weeks. So we should try to achieve as high as possible time in range if we can, without, of course, sacrificing hypoglycemia. That's the most important thing. But also we need to employ our knowledge with our patient to say, is this tool better than this other for you? And right now, in the States, we have 3 automated insulin delivery. Those can encourage the patient to be more tight because there's very low risk for hypoglycemia. So that's another thing that makes the patient more comfortable. So I would say let's try to still strive for a higher time in range. We also need to be consistent with our measurements, microalbumin. You know, we know sometimes in primary care, this might be done, might not be done. So again, how do people evaluate? 50% of people don't go to the eye doctor. So that's another issue that we have in the States. So all these things that we know can be affecting our patients, we need to be more coherent, actually consistent, I should say, with our measurements of the potential complication very consistently from when they come to see us every single year. The other thing that I'm thinking would be so phenomenal would be to say the cohort starts here. If we do any intervention, whether it would be try to decrease hypoglycemia, work with the patient a particular way, is it counting carbs better, changing the type of insulin delivery system, we'll be able to achieve. But that requires a very long duration of follow-up. And then again, because in the States, at least we have so many different practitioners, these people have everything in the same system. It was wonderful for us to see, is the eye disease getting better? Who's measuring it? What method? We have so many different people who do in different areas, and if patients are not followed by endo for type 1, actually, many of them are not followed at all by us in endo. So we don't know how these patients are followed. So that's where it becomes more of a challenge for us. And I would say if we could extend CGM to primary care for type 1 or type 2, people who really need it, that maybe can improve over time, over years, our patients' health overall.
And with that, I would like to thank Allison Myers and Grazia Aleppo for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope that you all learned as much as I did and that you will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.